Tika Ballas, and this is Hometown Alaska. Today we are taking a look at the state of affairs of nonprofits here in Alaska. Nonprofit entities all over the country are beginning to feel the pressure of hard economic times as individual donors and corporate sponsors cut back. Well, Americans have gone through hard times before, but historically, it's the nonprofits and charities that have come to the rescue. Well, is that going to be the case now? Here in Alaska, we like to boast and brag that we're not as high at risk as the rest of the nation. Well, even if that's true, Alaskans are feeling at least a similar economic crunch. Gas prices are rising, homeless shelters are over capacity, and every sector is looking at cutbacks. And a bad economy is just one of the problems nonprofits face. Running a not-for-profit business is not an easy feat, but nor is it impossible. There are just a lot of hurdles to overcome. Well, my guests today are here to talk about the multitudes of things the organizations face, as well as the different factors here in Alaska that make them unique, different than those in the lower 48. In the studio here with me today is Dennis McMillan, president and CEO of the Forica Group. For 21 years, Dennis has served as the development officer and then as a CEO with United Way in numerous communities around the country. He came to Alaska in 92 to lead the United Way of Anchorage. And in 2001, Dennis led the effort to start the Forica Group with the mission of building sustainable and organized Alaska nonprofits. It has been announced that next month, Dennis will be honored as a shining light by the congregation Beth Shalom for his achievements in public service and for promoting the common good. Good afternoon, Dennis. Welcome to the show and congratulations.
Thanks, Tika. It's good to be here.
And we also have in the studio with us today is President and CEO of Alaska Community Foundation, Candace Winkler. She is formerly the CEO of Thread Alaska, a group that connects childcare and education. She has an interesting and diverse background in community service. In 2002, she was honored by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce with the Top 40 Under 40 Award. And in 2004, the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C. selected her as an emerging leader in the field of early care and education. Welcome to the show, Candace.
Thank you.
I do want to point out for our listeners that the Alaska Community Foundation and APTI are partners in an exciting new project we are calling Town Square 49. It's about citizen engagement issues, but I can't tell you any more than that because the rest of it will be revealed later on this year. Again, this is Hometown Alaska, and today we're discussing the state of nonprofits here. If you would like to join this conversation, have comments or questions for either of my guests, please call in at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Now, to start the show off, I think a lot of Alaskans have heard the names Forica Group and Alaska Community Foundation, or ACF, but I think few really know what either one of those organizations are. I think most just think that they are nonprofit entities, but you are, in fact, more than that. In a few brief words, I'd like it if both of you can, and not at the same time, describe your group. Candace, let's go ahead and start with you, actually.
Okay.
Alaska Community Foundation, what is that?
Great. Well, the Alaska Community Foundation is a public foundation. Most folks are familiar with the Rasmussen Foundation, which is one private family foundation. And the Alaska Community Foundation, we're almost like a informal permanent fund for individuals, organizations, and communities throughout the state of Alaska to be able to put aside resources that can be used for current needs, but also that will be available in the future in perpetuity to help address changing needs that we have. And a lot of times, it's helpful for people to think about. Most folks are familiar with the United Way, and we can think about the United Way simplistically as kind of a checking account where the donations individuals give to United Way are spent in the current year to address a variety of needs in the health and human service area. The Alaska Community Foundation might be more like a savings account that is going to have probably a more permanent life cycle, and that in addition to addressing health and human services needs throughout the state may also, you know, address needs in the environment or around arts and cultural issues.
So ACF tends to use maybe more of the earnings off of investment money?
Correct.
And Dennis, can you tell us about Foraker? How are you slightly different from that or more different than that?
We're very, very different. Foraker Group was created with one purpose, and that was to strengthen the nonprofit sector in Alaska. And we do that through what's called capacity building. We serve as the state's nonprofit association, so we're like a chamber for nonprofits, and we provide different types of research, salary surveys, benefit surveys, other research that is beneficial for boards and staff when they're doing planning. We also provide a lot of training opportunities for staff and boards of nonprofits around Alaska. We do this through formal mechanisms, like we help with the undergraduate degree and business with a nonprofit emphasis at Alaska Pacific University. We've been doing that. We actually helped start that program 10 years ago. We have a certificate in nonprofit management through the University of Alaska system, where nonprofit leaders, execs, and people that want to be execs can go through and learn everything they need to know about running a nonprofit. We're doing a new program right now that Candace is participating in called the Catalyst for Excellence program. That is a different type of transitional leadership program to really work with people that have a 10, 20, 30-year potential staying power in the sector to really help transform the sector, nonprofit sector.
How do you ascertain if they have a 10 to 30-year staying
Just power? Basically, it's whether their age informs that or that they've just said, you know, I'm going to be doing this until I'm gone. And so somebody that was 70, it might be hard for them to do a 30-year, but they might be able to do a 10-year. So, and we do have people of all different ages in this program. And then we also have about 40 classes that are either designed for staff or for boards that are everything you need to know about serving on a board, fundraising, communications, that we've been providing around the state, both in classroom settings, and then we do a lot of distance delivery now around the state. So we're the association. We do training, formal and informal training. We have what are called our shared services, and these are backroom services, so small and medium nonprofits that maybe don't have an HR director, human resource director, can contract through Foraker and get people that are sensitive to the nonprofit sector and can help with a specific problem that's going on. We do financial work for almost 40 nonprofits around the state, so we're like a backroom finance department for 40 nonprofits around the state and do everything from their payables to receivables and payroll. And then we have a very unique program that's funded by a number of the larger funders called pre-development. And that is used when these funders are getting ready to invest in a new building for a nonprofit. We have a highly qualified staff and consultants that work with us to help those organizations go through the process of planning for that facility to make sure it's going to be built at the right size, at the right scale, and with the right resources so it's going to withstand Alaska winters and other forces. So that's our backroom offices that we call shared services. And then finally, we just do one-on-one organizational development. So we do a lot of strategic planning or going in and doing board retreats or staff retreats, or when there are different kinds of issues going on in an organization, going in and trying to help the organization.
Can an organization that's just burgeoning, just sprouting up really, can it come to you and then say, we just need some guidance on how to acquire the funding or what to do once we can they go from that level all the way up?
Yeah, we have people that are thinking about starting a nonprofit coming in the door, all the way to Providence Hospital. This is the largest employer in the state that uses Foraker services. So virtually, we have about 500 members that are mainly nonprofits. We have about 30 of those are tribes. So some tribes also benefit from Foraker services because they're very much like a nonprofit.
Well, if you have so many that are still just coming into your doors just now, there are more than 6,000 nonprofits in the state of Alaska, if I recall
right. The new data, we just completed our second study with the Institute for Social and Economic Research, ICER, and their best guesstimate of nonprofits operating in December of 2010 was 7,027. And if you want to do the math, that's one for every 97 Alaskans. It's one for every 69 adults. and arguably, probably, if not the highest density of nonprofits in the galaxy, close.
Yeah, it sounds like from what the numbers that I had been reading, we're older than 2010, but those are good numbers. But even then, we're way over and above any other state in the nation per capita in any way. So that's a lot of nonprofits in a not so densely populated state. Why?
Well, you know, Dennis will have some thoughts on this as well, but you know, I think Alaskans by nature are independent, and so I do think that there is an element of folks, you know, some of the nonprofits. So let me back up. The Alaska Community Foundation, in addition to sort of holding endowments for organizations who might be kind of trying to set up their own savings account, also playing the role of helping individuals set aside philanthropic dollars and helping community groups set aside, for instance, like the Seward Community Foundation. That's, you know, that's one of our affiliate agencies, set up funds. We also do something we call fiscal sponsorship, where we work with groups of individuals who might come together and have a charitable purpose. And we will work with them. So instead of them needing to go out and create their own 501c3, we can help provide some of that kind of back-end infrastructure to help them accomplish a goal. So for instance, you know, one example would be the Planet Walk downtown was a project that a high school student came up with, and some folks in the community wanted to see that come to fruition. And so we were, instead of that group setting up a 501c3 and becoming their own nonprofit, we were able to kind of work with them, accept charitable donations, see that project through to completion, and, you know, then, you know, there was no need to kind of create this
so
other.
So you can act as an umbrella at that point.
Yes. I think what I have seen, I probably have requests 2 to 3 times a week for different groups who would like us to act in that capacity. And in a lot of scenarios, it makes sense for an organization like the Alaska Community Foundation to act as that fiscal sponsor. But a lot of times what I see are individuals who do have a very good idea and maybe do have a charitable project they want to work on. But often, you know, there is somebody else out in the community that might be doing similar work. And so I do think that there is an element of kind of that independent spirit and people wanting to do it on their own and not necessarily looking to see, is there a group that I may be able to work with and we can utilize our resources more efficiently and effectively. I don't know, Dennis, what are some of your thoughts?
One of my favorite stories was the year 4-Acre founded in 2001. I traveled to McCarthy, and back then I had traveled the state and I'd been to McCarthy before, but I was going on the web and I was looking at all the organizations I could find in every community and I also learned just basic information about places. And so at that point, I think McCarthy had a population year round of 39, and it would go up to about 300 in the summertime. And we figured at that point that McCarthy must be the epicenter of this density thing, because with 39 year-round employees, there were 15 registered nonprofits at that point. And, you know, there were the Friends of the Road and the Enemies of the Road and the Friends of the Bridge and the Enemies of the Bridge. And then there was the church, and then there was the little museum. And that's what happens, is we have people, like Candace said, that want to do it their way. And it's been very easy. Internal Revenue Service would probably contradict this, but I think an Internal Revenue Service, and they're the gatekeepers on organizations that can become, as Candace said, a 501c3 is a charitable nonprofit. And not all nonprofits are charitable, but most of them are. And I think they make it kind of easy for people to go and organize these things. You know, while we have 7,000 nonprofits, that is the guess from ICER, in Alaska, there are actually over 8,000 that have incorporated in the state of Alaska. That's the state of Alaska data point. But a lot of those are dormant nonprofits that were started at some point. Somebody had a great idea and started something. And many of those never went to the federal government to try to get a tax status, a legal tax status.
Well, it seems to me that there would be a lot of problems that are incurred with having so many nonprofits, right? Not only do you have a lot of organizations then doing the same things,
yeah,
or very similar to, but it means, if I'm right, that there's a lot of stretching of the dollar. Mm-hmm. And also there's this problem of board members. Don't nonprofits have board members?
That's the biggest one issue. I mean, money's an issue, but the biggest issue that we think there is out there is there are not enough people to serve on all these boards. And we have many Alaskans that serve on two or three or four boards, and that's probably too many for most of those folks. That really gets at the basis of this. You cannot have a nonprofit organization without a board. It's a legal requirement. State of Alaska requires three to become incorporated, and you have to be incorporated in a state to get IRS tax status, so it's kind of a first step. And like I said, you know, we have one nonprofit for every 69 adults. Not all adults are engaged in their community. Not all adults vote, even if mm-hmm. they have the capacity to. And so we have a much smaller pool of adults that are really thinking about community, wanting to be on a board. So we have nonprofits that get started a lot of times with a great idea, but they cannot find board members. Or if they get board members, it's the board members that stay forever and ever and ever, which is not good for an organization. So that is a big issue, and Candace is dealing with that. I deal with that. It's a huge issue in our state.
Well, Candace, how does ACF know how to allocate funds? Say if a donor says, I want to allocate my funds to students and writing, and there's 25 writing groups. How does the organization know how to allocate those funds appropriately?
Well, Tika, let me first just expand off one piece that you and Dennis were just speaking about, which was the challenge with board members. And I do think that that's the number one challenge. But I would also add that I think having qualified, competent staff also becomes a real challenge when you have that many nonprofits and such a low population base like we have. And in particular, what I've seen is a real challenge in some of the more technical areas. Very hard, from my experience and from talking to other executives, you know, to find accounting, finance people, CFOs, fund development people. That's always a challenge to find folks in human resources. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, the Foraker Group really has developed and expanded some of their shared services to be able to help bridge that gap for a lot of nonprofits that are not able to find or afford that kind of talent that you need. With your question, from the Alaska Community Foundation, how do we determine where resources go? It really depends on the type of fund. We're a pretty complex organization with about seven different types of funds. And so how we provide grant dollars really varies. You know, just to give a sense to you and to your listeners, last year we gave out about $6.5 million in grants. Our kind of permanent asset size were right below $50 million. And, you know, the donor advised funds, which typically tend to be, you know, individual families who are setting up of philanthropic fund, they tend to make determinations on what organizations they would like to support. And so typically, you know, they may say we'd like to support, you know, Beans Cafe or Catholic Social Services. And our job really is to do some due diligence and make sure that those organizations are in good standing and that they are eligible organizations to receive those funds. In addition to that, we also have types of funds that we either called like field of interest or our affiliate community funds that are a little bit broader in nature. And so typically they may have some sort of application process. And, you know, we have those on our website and individual organizations apply for funds mm-hmm. based on any particular criteria that a fund may have. For instance, we have a disaster response fund. And so, you know, communities or organizations can apply for those funds if they've experienced a disaster, and, you know, we'll evaluate those based on kind of need and priorities, and just like you would any other kind of competitive grant cycle.
Now, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Hometown Alaska, and our guests today are Candace Winkler of the Alaska Community Foundation and Dennis McMillan of the Dennis McMillan of the Foraker Group. Dennis, who will be honored as a shining light by the Congregation of Beth Shalom for his achievements in public service and for promoting the common good. If you should have a question for either of our guests, you can call us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. Now, Dennis, with this whole hotbed of so many different nonprofits here in this state, there seems to be, if you have so many of them coming to you just to get started up, is there a point where you try to discourage or have them maybe work in conjunction with one already pre-existing?
Even if what these people are coming in with is a very good idea, we always encourage them to not start a nonprofit and to try to think of another way of accomplishing their dream. I think that's been the case since we started. It's not that we are the nonprofit cops that say, no, you shouldn't be joint, you shouldn't be an independent 501c3. But people have a very naive notion about what it takes to do this. And it takes a lot more work than anybody would even think about to do something like this. I mean, they just say, well, all I have to do is go, you know, do articles and go to the state of Alaska or file with the IRS and I can have a nonprofit. And then, oh, by the way, when that happens, money falls from trees. I mean, that's what people think. And the reality is, you know, those are legal things that you have to do. And those are the easiest thing to do. The hardest things to do are to get a board. The second hardest thing to do is to figure out your business model and where you're going to get your resources to be sustainable. The Alaska Community Foundation, the effort to create the Alaska Community Foundation started in 1993-94. I had just gotten to Anchorage. I was in the room when people were trying to do this. And you had some of the, you know, most connected people in our community sitting around the table. And, you know, before the Community Foundation got to a place where it was truly a sustainable venture, it took 8 years. And that's with all the right resources in the room in the beginning. So when people come to us with love, we tell them, this is a tough thing that you're thinking about doing. Could you, you know, and we do know a lot of organizations. So we can say, what about this organization or what about that organization? But as Candace said, I mean, we're Alaskans and we want to do it our way. There is, you know, there are some legitimate reasons why there are so many, and some has to do with the, you know, the far-flung places we live. Mm-hmm. It's really hard, you know, for one soup kitchen to serve our state. Mm-hmm. You know, you need soup kitchens in a lot of communities or food banks, or you need, you know, people want to have art in their community, and so, you know, you can't just homogenize everything and call it good because we've reduced. We have less government. We have a lot of areas of the state that are not even incorporated. But even where we have incorporations, our governments do less here than they do in the lower 48. We don't have the county bureaucracy. We don't have cities in a lot of places. So nonprofits here do a service way beyond what happens in the lower 48. And that's, if there's a legitimate reason why we have so many, it's because we are different. I have been in 129 communities since 4 Acres started around the state. And that means, you know, spending the night there, knowing the people there. I feel a part of those communities and people embrace me as, for the most part, as not a stranger. People are very different. Communities are very different. Cultures are very different. And so that's one of the reasons. Nationally, states that tend to be more rural have more nonprofits than states that are urban.
That it's not even about, what you're saying is that it's not really about poverty then so much, because we are overall a wealthy state, especially compared to our neighbors. But we have so many nonprofits, more because you're saying that we don't have the government entities and setups within rural Alaska to help deliver services, correct?
Or even in urban Alaska.
Or even urban, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's all over.
So Candace, actually, other than that, like, what else? There are nonprofits all over the state, and you watch how a lot of them work. Both of you do. And there are nonprofits in rural America in the lower 48.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, there's a lot of things that make them different from the nonprofits that function here. Could you tell me, like, a little more about what some of those are, what those differences are?
Well, I do think, you know, some of the things that Dennis was pointing out, I mean, just our geographic challenges and, you know, the need to have some services that are developed locally, you know, in other places, in Nebraska or other places that have rural areas, you know, it's still easy to get into a car and drive 2 or 3 hours and be connected. And so from that perspective, you know, there is still the ability to have maybe more centralized organizations that, you know, have offices or are providing services in different locations. And that can provide the opportunity for more economies of scale. I mean, you know, Dennis can attest, both of our organizations are statewide. It's very challenging to be statewide in Alaska. I mean, the cost of travel, the challenges of trying to truly have a board of directors that is representative of the entire state. So I think those are some of the differences that we face here in Alaska that, you know, other states that may have rural communities, they're much more connected to one another. They, you know, typically have pretty strong road systems and people can kind of get around them. And I also am not sure that there's really the diversity of communities in any given state that we have here in Alaska.
So let's take this conversation to the fiscal aspect of it. You know, we are in a recession of sorts going on right now, and money is starting to get harder to come by. People are giving a lot less. Corporations are cutting back. Do you see with the nonprofits, particularly those that deal with rural Alaska, are they affected as greatly as other nonprofit entities, or in contrast even to what's going on in the lower 48?
Well, you know, the other real difference, and this is partially back to the question you would just ask Candace, but I'll get to the financial side. One of the huge differences in Alaska is the Alaska Native cultures, the regional corporations. We have many, many nonprofits in this state that are significant nonprofits that are really part of the Alaska Native system. And in some ways, it's duplicative of other services, but very few states have that dynamic. And that does create a change. But getting specifically to the financial considerations, Alaska nonprofits do not generate as much earned revenue as in the lower 48. It's kind of a misnomer when you think about charities. You think about, well, they're always out begging to get money to, you know, pay for themselves. Well, the reality is most income coming into nonprofits is earned. And that's around the country and in the state. But in Alaska, we generate less earned income, and we've been getting more income that was provided by the federal government specifically than any other state. We had ICER, when they did our study that came out in December of 2010, we asked them to separate out government funding. We wanted to see government funding that was more the entitlement programs, the BIA, IHS, Indian Health Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, or other funds that would be more like earned revenue because the government is paying an entity, usually a nonprofit, to provide services. Those kind of funds are golden. Those kind of funds are sustainable or more sustainable. However, we also said, okay, but tell us about these grants. And a lot of these would have been what we used to know as earmarks that we all know are kind of going away. And in the lower 48, the average for that kind of grant funding is about 9% of total income for nonprofits. In Alaska, it's 43%. That's a billion. $1 billion.
Okay, you totally difference. Surprised me right there.
Okay.
Wow.
So,
and you're saying it's about $1 billion difference?
It's about $1 billion difference. If we were to go down to 9%, that would be $1 billion that would evaporate tomorrow. Now, do I think it's all going to evaporate? No. But do we think it's going to evaporate? Yes. And for a lot of different reasons, because The last study we did, which had data from 2003, it was 53% of all income in Alaska was these government grants, primarily the earmark types. And it dropped from 53% of the total to 43% of the total over a four-year period. And our best guesstimates about what happened, the data that where it was 43% was from 2007. And we asked ICER to really look at 2008, 2009. And it looks like it kind of bottomed out at about 36%. But then it bounced back up in 2009 because of the federal stimulus program, which, again, is not sustainable.
Right.
So our whole system is built on that. And a lot of that money was going into rural Alaska. And in rural Alaska, you're really talking about very small private sector employment. The employment is either government, tribal, which is government, or nonprofit. So I really am concerned, and I'm going to be on a roadshow starting this summer where I'll go to hopefully every chamber, every rotary. I'll talk to any leadership group I can go to around the state and deliver this data because it's not to be like Chicken Little spreading fear and lack of hope, but to give people facts so they can make good decisions about what we need to do to keep the quality of life that we've anticipated in the state where we want it.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Hometown Alaska, and our guests today are President and CEO of Alaska Community Foundation, Candace Winkler, and President and CEO of the Forica Group, Dennis McMillan. And on our website, you will find links to both of their organizations under Hometown Alaska at kska.org. If you have any questions for our guests, or if you would just like to call in and share some of your experience with running your nonprofit organization here in the state of Alaska, go ahead and give us a call at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or you can email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. So we're talking a lot of money here. We're talking about a lot of money and a lot of people who need money in order to give money. And it seems from what both of you are saying is that too much dependence is on either corporate and predominantly these temporary grants.
From the federal government.
From the federal government. So how, before we go how, where do we turn our attention to make it more feasible to keep nonprofits running and stable? Where should that money really come from then?
It should come from earned revenue, because that's sustainable. When a nonprofit has a product or service that they can charge for, that is earned revenue.
But not all nonprofits have something.
Right. So Beans Cafe can't do that because you can't charge people that are homeless for their meals. But a lot of nonprofits can generate money there, and the ones that can should focus that way. Girl Scouts generate most of their operating budget from earned revenue, the cookies. Mm-hmm. So even, organizations that you wouldn't think of as supported by earned revenue are really supported by earned revenue. So that's one sustainable revenue stream. The other sustainable revenue stream is individual charitable giving, where you go and ask an individual to write you a check.
Yeah.
And in that realm, Alaska is far behind the norm around the country.
Right.
We're used to getting a check from the state. Yeah. We're not used to giving money. We're not used to paying taxes. We have a very entitled state, and people think that way, even though people would be horrified to think of living in a socialist country, a lot of Alaskans, and in many ways we do, because we depend on government to do all sorts of things for us here that people in the lower 48 don't even think about.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think that the earned revenue is certainly one strategy, but I think that here in Alaska, we have a tremendous amount of potential in individual giving to grow and develop that. I think that, right now we're at the very end, the last, I think, week for Pick, Click, Give, which is an opportunity for many Alaskans, almost all Alaskans, receive a permanent fund check, and there's an opportunity to give part of those resources to charity. I think this year, actually, it's going to come in maybe around 3% is what the numbers are looking like.
Of all the people, and it's not too, even if you've already filed for your permanent fund dividend, you can still go on the website and you can still make a contribution. And we would be remiss if we didn't say, do that now.
Yeah.
Turn off the radio for a second and go do that. No, just listen to us and then go do it.
Yes. Well, you know, I do think that, you know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about why are our individual giving levels low? And I do think that, you know, Dennis pointed to a couple of those. I mean, we don't have an income tax here. We do receive a permanent fund check. And so I think some of those are, you know, sort of ingrained. I mean, we're not a state where people are being asked on an ongoing level to participate in helping to support those things that are important to building quality of life across our state, that we tend to have focused on government resources. And we also have a higher percentage of corporate giving than most other states. And so we've really looked at those as ways to fund those things that we think are important in a community. You know, I do think, you know, being a younger state, we may have not developed some of those tools or infrastructure that I think have encouraged individual giving. And before the show started, you know, Dennis and I were talking a little bit about community foundations. And in a lot of places around the nation, you know, they've had community foundations for 75, even 100 years. And I think those are core and central ways that individuals have seen that they can give back and set up resources that are their just individual way to support the things they care about in perpetuity in their community. Mm-hmm. The Alaska Community Foundation is only 15 years old, so we are very young. And as Dennis said, you know, it took the first, you know, 8 years for us really to kind of get up and running, because, you know, to build a sustainable, successful nonprofit, it takes time and it takes energy. And so I think that, you know, that some of those elements in a community help over time really change the trajectory. And my hope, you know, one of the things I've done, I have 4.5-year-old twins, and one of the things that we did is, you know, we have worked with them, my husband and I, you know, with the Pick, Click, Give, to help them see us being philanthropic and supporting nonprofits and being engaged in our community. And my hope is that if more and more people are doing that, we will create over the next generation a much stronger pool of individuals who are, you know, seeing it as their responsibility to contribute to improving the quality of life across Alaska.
And you just touched on something that I want to come back to about philanthropics, but we're going to come back to that in just 1 minute after this break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska, and we are discussing today nonprofits in our state. Our guests are President and CEO of Alaska Community Foundation, Candace Winkler, and President and CEO of the Foraker Group, Dennis McMillan. On our website, you will find links to both of those organizations at kska.org. If you would like to share with this conversation, we don't have a whole lot of time left here and a whole lot of ground still to cover, but you are free to call in and join us at 550-8433. That's 550-8433, or go ahead and shoot us an email at hometownalaska@kska.org. In fact, we do have an email right here just now. It says, are there nonprofits that have been abandoned or fallen into disrepair that more enthusiastic persons could take over and make useful again?
Probably. There's a process. I mean, there's a legal process. If someone has founded a nonprofit and created it, they have to be the ones, the board of that nonprofit, even if they've fallen into disrepair, have to do a disillusionment or a transfer. And then you have to do new articles of incorporation and register with IRS again. So it's really almost, you don't have to start from scratch, but you kind of do.
So it's not like there's a graveyard you can just go through and say, you know, that was a really good one.
The used car lot for nonprofits. No, there's not such a thing.
Okay. On a different bend, we were just before the break, we were discussing about the philanthropy of showing your children, Candace, that you're doing the
Pick, click, give.
I need to work on that
one. It's okay. It's good.
See, maybe I need to do it as well this year.
Yeah. Everyone needs to do it this year.
And that's a great point, because I think for many of us, we think of philanthropy as something that only very wealthy people do.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not just this means, but there are many ways, correct?
There are many ways. And, you know, really, I think there are ways for people, and that's what's so fabulous about Pick, Click, Give is, you know, I think the minimum donation is $25. So that's pretty accessible to most folks to be able to give, you know, some portion. And of course, those that can, we would encourage to give, you know, to give more of that. But, you know, I do think that there are many ways that people can give, you know, their time, their talents, and their resources. And, you know, one of the things that we try to do at the Alaska Community Foundation is to have either sort of field of interest funds. I talked a little bit about, you know, the disaster preparedness, or, you know, we have, you know, the Anchorage Parks Foundation is a group that has worked with us for times. We also have these community-based affiliates, which I think are a great way to encourage people who maybe don't feel like they can, you know, set aside $100,000 or a large amount of money to set up their own donor-advised fund, but want to participate in building their communities. And so these are more community-based philanthropy, and they're opportunities for people to give what they can and to get involved in helping to shape what the needs in their particular communities are, what those goals are, what would be the things that would improve the quality of life.
You know, and I think there's a balanced diet for philanthropy. I think, you know, if people are engaged in, you know, a religious institution, if they go to a church or a synagogue, giving there, of course, makes sense. If you've benefited from a really good education at an educational institution, it makes really good sense to be a member of the Alumni Association or to give something back to where you especially got a college education. You know, giving to United Way every year is a good way of meeting lots of basic needs in communities and having impact on social issues in communities. Giving money to Alaska Community Foundation, a lifetime gift, is a good thing for people to do. Giving to Alaska Public Telecommunications, Inc., or KSKA, KAKM, and Candace and I are sitting here, and we give to all those things. And that's a balanced diet in philanthropy, is we don't – it's not about giving to one thing. It's about finding out what's important to you and giving whatever you can at the level that's appropriate for you to as many things as you feel good about giving to.
Yeah. And as the state of philanthropy, we do have on the line Dale. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for this program. I've only been listening to it for a few weeks, but it certainly addresses important issues. And this one in particular, I'm the president of the Wasilla Kinnick Historic Society, and we, until 2 years ago, owned a historic building in Wasilla that was donated to us, and we refurbished and made it habitable and so on, and we leased the upstairs out to a business, profit-making business, to generate some income for us. And then because of the high maintenance on the building, we sold it to the city and then leased it back for $1 a year for 99 years. We still maintain and contract out the business. Now the city is taxing us as a profit-making business. And the first time we've made any money at all is when we rented the upstairs out to the food service business. And we had an attorney's opinion who said that we shouldn't be charged, but in order to fight it, it would cost more money than we could possibly come up with. And I'm wondering if anyone had an avenue that we could look at, or advice, or anything.
Well, this is Dennis, and it's a good question, because a lot of people, when they are in a nonprofit and they're working on earned revenue, need to understand that your only earned revenue that's acceptable, where you don't have to pay tax like you're a for-profit, is mission-related earned revenue, which means if the organization's purpose is to restore and maintain a building, then that's probably how that attorney that you spoke with said that they would fight this and say, well, it is mission related, because it's our business to, you know, manage this building and maintain this building. But he's also right that it would probably take more money to fight City Hall than it would just to pay the tax. A lot of nonprofits pay unrelated business tax on income that they generate that is not mission related. So it's, again, another misnomer that if you're a nonprofit, you don't pay taxes. If you're generating revenue that's not mission related, you have to pay tax just like a for-profit. And we encourage people to just support their communities that way and where it makes sense. But when I was the CEO of the United Way in Anchorage, it owned property, still does. And there was a very lengthy process of working with the municipality to get those properties tax exempt. And we did get that done eventually, but it did cost money.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, every cent that we do take in goes to support and maintain the Kinnick Museum. And so we're not finished yet in discussing things with the city, but it still seems dismal at this point.
Well, that's too bad, but it's
paying those taxes.
Yeah, but it's what happens, but I commend you for doing that and supporting the museum at Kinnick, and that's a great thing to be doing.
Yeah. Thank you, Dale.
Thank you.
That does bring me to the next question I was going to ask was about earned revenue, oddly enough, was about counseling and advising different nonprofits on how to go about. I mean, do either organizations help counsel in any way a nonprofit that says we need, I'm assuming the Forica group more so, but
yeah.
We need to figure out a way to come up with more money. Do you do counseling into how to come up?
We don't do counseling. We help organizations vision. We help them do kind of strategic thinking, doing a strategic plan. But we also have developed an expertise in helping nonprofits create business plans. And this is really a new venture around the country. 4-Acre Group in Alaska is kind of ahead of the curve on helping nonprofits develop nonprofit business plans. If you've been to business school, there's something called ROI, return on investment. And that's what you do in a business plan, is you basically talk about how you're going to make investment and then how you're going to get a return on that investment. In the nonprofit world, there's a double bottom line. There's return on investment, just like it is in a for-profit. You've got to make money if you're going to do this stuff. But there's also something called return on social investment, ROSI. So what is the good you're doing for the greater good by this business venture? And So, yeah, we've been helping numerous nonprofits do business plans and advising them how they might be able to generate earned revenue that is mission-related, or if they decide to step outside of mission. And an example of that would be a nonprofit that says maybe is going to open a store, but they're selling things that are not at all related to their mission, then they're going to have to pay tax. But that's not a bad thing. Paying tax is not a bad thing. I know that a lot of people think it is, but paying taxes, how communities support themselves.
It's in its sense of its own philanthropy.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. And, I think that that the question that Dale just brought up and some of what Dennis has been sharing are just highlighting the complexities, I think, of running a nonprofit that a lot of folks who sort of, come in and have a vision or a goal and are excited by, some goal that they want to accomplish, don't necessarily always sort of think through that it can end up being a pretty complex business that you're mm-hmm. running and managing and trying to maintain to really reach sustainability and to, to have outcomes to make any movement on, whatever it is that you're trying to impact.
Well, I would have to say that by looking at these numbers of this incredible increase over the last few years of nonprofits, with all the problems of trying to find funding and board members and competent and educated people as staff and even reliable volunteers, it seems to me that why isn't it the other way around? Why aren't more volunteer or nonprofits rather becoming for-profit companies? It sounds like it would be easier for a lot of them.
It actually is sometimes. People think that when they become a nonprofit that money falls from trees. I can't say that enough. And having worked in the sector now for over 30 years, I've never seen it fall from a tree. It's always a lot of hard work. A lot of business leaders in this community, as a matter of fact, have a condescending attitude toward nonprofits and thinking nonprofits are just somehow substandard. My experience of working with business leaders for the past 30-plus years around the country, corporate CEOs, those kind of folks, as well as nonprofit leaders. As nonprofit leaders are a lot more entrepreneurial. They're a lot better managers of people and time than most for-profit businesses. Hmm. So I think a lot of nonprofit people probably could do quite well in a for-profit world. And now we're seeing a lot of for-profit people retiring and coming into the nonprofit world, mainly because they want to feel good. And that's the big difference is nonprofits are here for the greater good. They're not here for personal benefit. People can make salaries and
that
kind of stuff.
And there's an array of different serving. Like I was reading lists of, there's a huge list obviously of like 7,000 online that I was going through in Alaska. I was surprised. I think a lot of us don't think about what our nonprofit, the volunteer fire department, of course they're a nonprofit. What I did find interesting was going through some of not the more recent study, but one of the older ones that showed that the arts and culture nonprofit sector employs the least of all the nonprofit sectors, health, social services, civic, and education, right?
Right.
And they employ about half of what the education sector employs. Yet there are more arts and culture nonprofits than any other sectors.
Yeah.
And now, do you think that says something about there being too many nonprofits again, or is that the overlapping of services, or does that speak more about the social need for arts and culture in our outlets? Ooh.
That's a really good question. My first stab at that might be related more to what it is that they're delivering. That a lot of times when you get into kind of health and social service nonprofits, a lot of the social services you're delivering, the biggest expenditure is in your staffing, right? You need people to be, serving food to the homeless. You need people to, if you're providing counseling services from a nonprofit perspective, it's staff that are providing those services. And I think, arts and culture, certainly there are people and individuals involved in that, but a lot of it is sort of the creation of the product or the process too. I don't know. Dennis?
Again, this gets back to the rugged individualism of Alaskans, and we want to do it our way. And there are, you know, nuanced differences between a lot of the organizations that do art. I would say that, you know, and this is not just Alaska, that this data point you picked out about, you know, a lot of organizations, but not a lot of employment and not a lot of expenditures, that seems to be the case around the country. But what we also know is where communities support a vibrant arts culture, that economic development is easier. Mm-hmm. People want to live in communities with good arts. And I think, again, business leaders sometimes minimize how important it is to have an opera, to have a symphony, to have, you know, good theater. But going back, there was one other thing I wanted to make, and Candace was talking a lot about, you know, the giving piece. And I think you brought up about how corporations here give more. I think it's very important to say that nationally, corporate giving only represents 5% of all the money that's given in America. So the kind of, you know, when a big corporation writes a check, this is not their employees or anything like that. This is just their corporate money. It's only 5% of all the money that's raised in America comes that way. But in Alaska, BP by itself and ConocoPhillips by themselves each give about 5% of total philanthropy in Alaska.
Wow.
They give so disproportionately here to anywhere else in the country. And then when you add in all the other money that they leverage through the oil industry and then all the other very generous organizations, banks, and all that give in the state, we're probably three times, if not more, as much corporate giving here as in the lower 48. So again, people in Alaska depend on foundation giving beyond the national norm, corporate giving, and money from the federal government, and a lot less on individual giving. And that is where Candace spends her time, is working on growing individual giving through the Community Foundation.
Just helping provide opportunities for people to be engaged and involved. And again, you know, that really can range from, you know, people giving really small amounts of money and time and interest to, you know, to people who have the resources to, you know, to give a lot. And we like to be there to be able to provide that. You know, one thing that that I don't want to kind of leave out there is, there are times when it makes sense for new nonprofits to kind of come on the scene. But I do think, you know, as we've discussed during this past hour, we have a lot of nonprofits. And, you know, running a nonprofit and finding the resources to have that nonprofit be sustainable, you know, it takes a lot of energy and time and effort. And I think there are lots of opportunities for creative partnerships and collaboration. And I think that's the phase that I see a lot of nonprofits moving into in some of the changing landscape that we have. Dennis has talked about how we really are seeing less federal dollars coming in. I think we've seen, you know, some reductions in some of the corporate giving. So as we are trying to build that individual giving, we are also trying to really look at ways nonprofits can be creative, collaborate, and be more efficient with the resources they have.
And that is a great place to go ahead and draw this show to an end. An apology to our callers who did call here at the end that we couldn't get to you. I would like to thank our celebrity nonprofit guests today for volunteering their time. Candace Winkler of the Alaska Community Foundation and Dennis McMillan of the Foraker Group. Next week, March 30th, on Hometown Alaska, Charles Wolforth will be speaking with officials about tsunami warnings and emergency procedures. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Speck engineered today's program. And I am Tika Ballas. Thank you for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.